Welcome back to the Vatican Briefing, National Catholic Reporter's podcast covering Pope Francis and the big decisions facing the global Catholic Church. I'm Joshua McElwee, the Reporter's news editor.
And hello, I'm Christopher White, the Reporter's Vatican correspondent.
Later in this episode, we'll hear from El Paso Bishop Mark Seitz, a passionate voice for better treatment of migrants reaching the U.S.-Mexico border. Seitz, who is also the chairman of the U.S. Bishops Migration Committee, was in Washington earlier this month for a conference, and we were able to speak together about his concerns about the militarization of the border, the upcoming presidential election, and what it's like to be singled out for praise by Pope Francis. Stick around, it's really an interesting and engaging interview with a really earnest voice in this difficult time. But before we get to that, Chris, there's a lot to talk about. We're speaking today on Wednesday, April 24th. You're coming back from a trip to England where you covered an interesting speech by one of the key advisors serving to the Vatican Synod of Bishops.
That's right, Josh. I was there in Cambridge last week for a lecture by Anna Rowlands, who is a real force in the Synod organization. She's a theologian at Durham University, but she's also serving as an official theological advisor. And in this talk that she gave at Cambridge, I sort of refer to it as a State of the Synod address because it was quite sweeping in scope. I think it's perhaps the most candid and thorough assessment of the Synod from anyone officially sort of attached to the Synod office. And it comes at this interesting moment in between these two sessions in Rome. So listeners will remember last October was the first of two parts of the Rome sessions of the Synod on Synodality. And just last month, the Vatican announced that Pope Francis has established 10 working groups to deepen the study of some of the controversial issues that had been raised during the Synod in October. So issues like the role of women in the church, the role of papal nuncios, and a lot of the hot button questions. And these study groups, it's a bit unclear as to how they will function. We know that they will report to the Synod next October, but they'll continue until June of 2025. And so it was interesting for Anna's address to come in this moment. And she talked about, you know, some of the successes and some of the failures. You know, well, readers can go to NCR online and read the full report from her lecture. But I want to talk about just a few things quickly. She said on the participation front, she acknowledged that the general participation in the Synod was lower than they had hoped for in terms of just Catholics from around the world that had participated. But the quality of participation was really significant, and that for many Catholics, this Synod provided a forum for the first time ever to feel as if their voices were really heard and listened to. She also talked about, you know, this is the sort of hard work that has to be done for a church that is trying to become less European, less Eurocentric, and more of a global institution, and that the Synod allowed for participation for Catholics from all around the church to begin to shift the balance of power. She spoke about the real challenge that the Synod found in finding adequate language, particularly when it comes to addressing the role of women in the church, and also in terms of welcoming LGBTQ people, and how there were fault lines that clearly emerged in this, and it's not exactly clear how they'll move forward. We'll continue to pay attention very closely to the working groups as they develop in the coming months in anticipation of next fall's meeting. I think readers wanting to get a sense of how a Synod insider views what's happening at the Vatican in this moment of the Synod, they'd be well advised to review Anna's lecture because I think it really hits on a number of major issues.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Chris. Thank you for your reporting. Thank you for going and bringing that to our readers at ncronline.org. I also found it interesting. It's kind of something we've talked about kind of a little bit, but Anna really put her finger on in terms of how the Pope doesn't seem to be so concerned about any particular issue in the Synod, but is really concerned about the overall process, getting Catholics talking amongst each other, getting, you know, this three-year consultation process going, and making that a style for the global church. It's interesting that she really, that seemed to be the overarching idea of her lecture, and in terms of understanding the Pope's style, that it's not about any particular issue, but it's about this very process of how do we consult with one another, how do we collaborate.
I think, you know, the Pope sees this Synod as training for the global church. That's why for so many of us, and particularly the organizers themselves, it's been experimental, and it's the refining of that practice that the Pope is most interested in, not the hot button issues. That being said, you know, Anna will be the first to say those issues really matter because they are the product of the Synod itself, and they are owned by the Synod because the people of God from around the world raise these issues up, and so they can't be ignored. They have to be understood and dealt with and addressed in a synodal way. And that, you know, will take some time and a lot of effort and will require using muscles that perhaps the church hasn't used that well.
Well, another point of interest to cover is that while you were in England covering this address by Anna Rowlands, the theologian advising the Synod of Bishops, Pope's ambassador to the U.S., Cardinal Christophe Pierre, was in Rome to take possession of his titular church. Of course, Cardinal Pierre was named a cardinal at the last consistory by Pope Francis, and every cardinal gets a church in Rome as the titular parish leader. He gave an interview while he was in Rome to talk kind of about the paradox, as he called it, of the U.S. church, kind of reflecting on how self-referential the U.S. church has become and how interested in kind of just a few sets of issues. It's pretty interesting that as this universal church is going through the synod process, kind of thinking about the big way of being Catholic, the Pope's very representative in Washington is kind of raising concerns about the U.S. church and whether it's become a bit too self-referential or too kind of conscripted by certain ideas.
Yeah, I think, you know, Cardinal Pierre is a diplomat. He's served in a number of countries across the globe representing the Holy See. But he speaks frankly, and I think we've seen him speak a bit more candidly, you know, in recent years. And one of the things that struck me was he said, look, there's a lot of good that has come out of the U.S. church, and that can't be ignored. But everyone has to be cautious against the temptation of individualism. And that's become a real challenge in the U.S. church, you know, by some leaders to perceive itself as sort of separate, independent from that of the universal church. And I think, you know, he issues these words as a sort of a warning, particularly, as you said, Josh, in light of this synod process, where the Pope is trying to invite the global church to recognize that it is just that, a universal church.
Well, one more thing we might mention in terms of the universal church before we talk about Bishop Seitz is, between the last time we spoke, the Vatican announced the Pope's upcoming trip this September to Asia, to Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, East Timor, and Singapore. It's quite interesting. The Pope is pressing forward, 87 years old, on what will be the longest trip of his papacy. Chris, you reported on it. It's interesting that the Pope is clearly wanting to continue with these travels, wanting to be among Catholics in different parts of the world and undertaking an incredible voyage at his age.
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite demanding. It's an ambitious trip. He's, you know, as you said, Josh, going to four countries, longest trip of his papacy. But these are issues in places that really matter to him. I mean, he's going to Indonesia, which is home to the world's largest Muslim population. He's going to places that are really feeling firsthand the effects of climate change, another one of his signature issues. He had wanted to make this trip, or a variation of this trip at least, in 2020, and that was delayed by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think for a while, a lot of people thought, well, you know, this will just be another casualty of the COVID pandemic, that it'll be a trip that the Pope won't be able to make. And no, he will be just a few months shy of his 88th birthday if he's able to make this, and he's pressing ahead. And this, of course, will be right before a very busy month for him. This is at the beginning of September. And in October, he'll have the Synod of Bishops in Rome meeting the entire month. It looks as if at the end of September, he'll also be going to Belgium and possibly Luxembourg. So this is a Pope who, 11 years in his papacy, wants to be very clear that he's still in charge. He's on the go, and he's determined.
Yeah, and there's still more trips yet on the agenda. He's talked about going to Argentina later in the year, maybe in November. So we're looking at a very active fall for an 87-year-old Pope who has a lot of issues on the table and a lot of things to balance. Maybe we should pivot now, Chris, to talk about why we wanted to speak with Bishop Seitz this week. He was in Washington for a conference at the Catholic University of America focused on Catholic responses to immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border. Listeners might know Bishop Seitz a bit from kind of recent news events when the Texas Attorney General targeted one of the ministries run by the Catholic Church at the U.S.-Mexico border, Annunciation House. Seitz spoke pretty forcefully in favor of continuing the ministry, of the work that the Catholic Church does to help migrants, and the Catholic teaching on migrants as human persons who are worthy of dignity and, as the Pope says, have every right to move and to be treated well when they move. Seitz has called against militarization at the U.S. border and has said Texas is kind of criminalizing migrants as they arrive. It was pretty interesting for me. This day-long conference was at Catholic U. There were two bishops, Seitz and also auxiliary bishop from Washington, Avelio Menjivar, who is also a Salvadoran migrant himself. He spoke about, you know, what it was like for him to arrive in the U.S. as a migrant, how he's been treated. Also interesting that this conference was held just 3 days after the Vatican released its newest document on human dignity, the doctrinal note from the Vatican's Dicaster for the Doctrine of the Faith, which has received a lot of press coverage, especially for how it has treated several issues of sexual ethics. particularly in terms of gender-affirming surgeries for trans individuals or the issue of child surrogacy for couples who are infertile and seeking a way to have children. But the document also treats a number of other human rights issues, including migration. And several speakers at the conference, including Seitz and Bishop Menjivar, spoke about the document and how helpful it is for Catholics at the border, Catholics working in migration issues, for it to be very clear what Catholic teaching is and how migrants should be treated. So I found it a very interesting kind of point in terms of a Vatican document, which is getting a lot of press on one issue, is also helping, clearly helping Catholic social ministers at the border.
Yeah, Josh, I think this is a really thorough interview that you have with Bishop Seitz, and the conversation covers a lot of ground, but the timing of it is really fortuitous because, as you said, there are a lot of pelvic issues that have really defined the coverage of this document, and for very good reason. But this is an attempt, I think, in this document to rebalance what the church sees as real grave threats to human dignity, where it's not just about bioethical concerns. And the document puts migration right up at the top of the list of those issues that are real challenges that the church considers to be a threat to human dignity. And I think to have Bishop Seitz's voice on that in this moment is quite consequential. So kudos to you for scoring that interview.
Well, I think that's a good place to get to the interview itself. So after the music, we'll be back with my interview with El Paso Bishop Mark Seitz. Bishop Seitz, thank you so much for joining us today on the Vatican Briefing Podcast.
Pleasure to be with you.
We're talking today as you're taking part in this conference at Catholic University on how the U.S. Church is responding to the reality of those in need at the U.S.-Mexico border. For people who aren't really aware of what's going on or maybe only hear segments on TV news, can you give a sense of what it's like day to day? What kind of needs do you and your diocese in El Paso confront each day?
I think people arriving to our border after having watched many of the reports in the media will be surprised at what they find. Because migration is a reality at the border that our community has lived for probably millennia, right? So we're a place of passage. The El Paso is well named. There's a mountain range that travels from south to north and ends in Ciudad Juarez, our sister city. There's another mountain range from south to north, north to south, that ends at downtown El Paso. And there's a passage right through, and that has been used from time immemorial. It's given a character, a certain identity to our place. And the fact that there's a border that's been drawn across where we live at the river that crosses between us, the Rio Grande, is a very secondary sort of reality in some ways, because it's never really stopped the passage. It identifies two different countries. And yes, of course, there are processes for people who are crossing the border and entering the United States, as well as for the United States crossing into Mexico. And the church has no objection to that, of course. But the reality recently has certainly been, you know, challenging what has been in place for many, many years. But if you were to come to El Paso now, you would find that contrary to the impressions people are given, there aren't hordes waiting at the border and crossing. Sometimes there are groups that pile up because they're not being processed into the United States. But when they come here and they're processed by the Border Patrol, in these times, they are generally asking for asylum, and they're processed. An initial evaluation is done. And then they are released to the shelter system that we have. The Diocese of El Paso currently runs 5 shelters in El Paso itself. They're at different churches and at my pastoral center. And there are many others. And one of the famous one that you hear about a lot is Annunciation House. And they serve as a shelter, but also kind of a coordinating institution. So there is really a quite orderly system by which we receive people, provide them with basic needs, food, shelter, clothing, and help them to make arrangements to go wherever they are hoping to go from there.
You mentioned the work of Annunciation House. I know that's been in the news a lot recently, and I was struck by your own speaking of the situation there at your recent talk at Fairfield University, which we reported on at ncronline.org. And in that talk, you spoke about the years of militarization at the border, the criminalization of migrants. I was struck by something you said about people of faith having a duty to resist criminalization of migrants. I kind of wonder, for someone who's not in Texas or someone who's looking at the situation, what do you think that kind of looks like for a Catholic looking at this and wondering what they should do or how they should resist this kind of criminalization of human beings?
Well, I think you've said it well, the criminalization of human beings for being human beings. Human beings migrate. If you've ever had your DNA tested, pretty soon you catch on, right? Oh my gosh, I didn't have any clue that I had people from, you know, Hungary in my in my genes, you know. And it's usually a mix from all over the place because people move. And they very often have done it because they felt there was no choice, because they had to leave for the sake of their own lives and that of their children and families. They had to find a place of refuge. That is more the case today than it has been in our recent past. During the 80s, 90s, and into the early 2000s, much of the migration was more economic, which has its own certain legitimacy, right? And countries have always provided means by which people could cross and work if they had more jobs in the country that is receiving them and then in the country they departed. But today, we find more people leaving because of life-threatening situations where they are. Our country, after World War II, had a bit of guilt on its conscience. Thanks be to God, we should have, because we realized that what we did for a lack of an asylum process was we turned away a boatload of Jewish people escaping Hitler. We sent them back to the concentration camps. And so we, along with the international community, developed these asylum laws. People escaping persecution are not criminals. They need to be able to find a place of refuge. And there are very few places of refuge in the world today, because many places are experiencing a great deal of instability, organized crime, and so on. And many people in many countries, even though they might need the workers and so on, they still feel like anyone from the outside is a threat. And so we see this process of criminalization. Where do people go? What options do we leave them with? How would you or I feel if we were in a situation where we needed refuge somewhere?
I wonder, as we're in this year now of an election season and the rhetoric is ramping up, are you worried that things at the border might even become even more politicized? And I wonder, how do you speak to Catholics who maybe are concerned about life issues but don't have the same concern in terms of how we treat migrants or how the churches or politicians are responding to the situation at the border?
This is a grave concern that I have, that it seems that politicians have latched on to immigration as a way to mobilize their bases. And they've found that when they can zero in to a kind of primordial fear that we have of the other, the person we do not know, if we can somehow influence the narrative by telling the story of an individual that commits a crime who's an immigrant, something like that, it raises these very fundamental fears. And it can also move them to support the candidate that assures that he or she is going to protect us from those fears. So we've seen it more and more in this country recently. And unfortunately, it's at the same time as the world is facing a kind of instability with especially the presence of organized crime, but also corrupt governments and so on, that has caused many people. We have more people in a situation of migration now than ever before in history. And yet, it's not beyond our ability to help if we would only decide that we ought to. So I'm concerned about the election period very much. And the other factor there is that, frankly, in this secularizing age, even people who consider themselves Christians are more formed, it seems, in their thoughts, in their behaviors, by the political sort of thinking than by church teaching. They want to make their Christianity fit their political outlook rather than the other way around, and that concerns me also.
You know, just a couple of days ago, the Vatican put out a new doctrinal statement that mentions a range of issues, and a lot of the focus has been on certain kind of sexual ethic issues, but one of the major points that the document raised up was about migration and the human beings need to migrate and how migrants should be treated and respected. Does something like that, you think, help in terms of putting this on the focus of for Catholics on, as an important issue?
Absolutely. It helps a lot. And the Vatican, and particularly, of course, Pope Francis, has been so important in this area. He's been able to kind of zero in on this really fundamental gospel issue of our time, and how prophetic that he has identified this from day one of his papacy and had the strength to be able to stand up against a lot of pushback in this world that has been so willing to deny the dignity and equality of people who have left everything that they know.
You mentioned Pope Francis, and I wondered if I could ask you, a couple of times he's mentioned you in interviews and in the papal trip to Marseille, coming back with the papal press corps, he mentioned you as a model of a bishop. What does it mean to you that the Pope knows your name, knows that kind of ministry, and thinks of you that way?
On a certain level, you know, I have to say, any of us who are given a pat on the back by the boss, we feel pretty good. When that boss happens to be the Holy Father, it's something that certainly I would never have imagined before, and I don't think I deserve as much credit as he gives. There are so many other leaders, so many other bishops that have been very, very strong and clear in this issue. But I'm grateful. You know, in a certain way, it's really been a tremendous support for my ministry. I'm a bishop at the border. I deal with these issues every day as a matter of fundamental work of the church and caring for our poor who are among us. And he's given me the cover, if you will, to be able to speak to these issues. There might still be a lot of people who end up being angry, but they better be ready to take on the Holy Father as well.
I don't want to make you reveal any private conversations, but I'm wondering, have you had a conversation with Francis about your diocese, about the situation at the border?
Just relatively brief ones. We had our ad limina visit in 2020, just before the pandemic hit, and the Pope was very gracious. I did a little report on the life of the diocese at the border. Prior to that, we had actually had him at Ciudad Juarez on the other side of the border during his papal trip. The bishops of my region, there are three of us who are close to one another, we had invited him, actually. Couldn't have heard anyway. That it wasn't the primary reason. We suggested that he might want to come, you know, on a route that many migrants take through Mexico. And then he did exactly that. So I had a chance to visit with him briefly there. He was very happy that our diocese had celebrated his visit as a binational community. He really wants us to see beyond borders. It's not like real life ends at the border, you know, and it's not like a border needs to be a place of confrontation. It can be a place of encounter. The Holy Father has really helped us to look at these issues, and as you say, he's been extremely supportive of our work.
I was traveling with the Pope with the Vatican Press Corps on that trip to Mexico, and that Mass in Juarez was incredible at the border. And the prayer the Pope said at the border fence, really incredible.
So meaningful.
I know you have to go back to the conference, but maybe if I could ask one more question. The Universal Church is in this synod process called by Pope Francis. We had the first assembly last October of the Synod of Bishops in Rome, a second assembly coming now in October 2024. How are the consultations going in El Paso? How are you looking to the next assembly? Are there certain issues that you or your diocese are hoping might get discussed in the next synod assembly?
So we're trying to continue the process of listening and trying to think about how we incorporate more listening into the work of the church. In the first round of synodal conversations, we employed the help of our local industrial areas foundation leaders who have established this sort of listening processes and really are the pros in some ways. So they've been extremely helpful. The Pope, by the way, has taken note of their work and invited them to Rome a couple of times. So we continue to work with them. We have some good leadership there that are very helpful getting to the grassroots. We also have a priest, a young priest who stepped up and has been very involved in our local organizing and then continental process. And eventually he was invited to the Synod as one of just something like six from North America lay and, well, himself as I think the only priest, if I'm not mistaken. There might have been somebody else who were at the Synod. He'll be going back in October. So we feel like we've got a pretty direct connection there with the work of the Synod. We're hoping to announce a pastoral plan very soon that has been influenced, almost vetted in a certain way by what we heard through our synodal process.
Well, Bishop Seitz, thank you so much for joining us on the Vatican Briefing. We really appreciate you being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Joshua.
Thanks again to Bishop Seitz for joining us on the Vatican Briefing this week. We're really grateful for his time. Chris, I was really struck listening back to the interview about how vocal Bishop Seitz was, kind of about the situation at the U.S. border and how kind of willing to name things as they are, specifically with regard to Catholic teaching and what it says about the treatment of migrants. A few things that stick in my head are his phrase that people escaping prosecution are not criminals. Where do people go? What options do we leave them with? I was also struck when we spoke a bit about the U.S. presidential election. He used the term grave concern, that he has grave concern about this presidential election season and how politicians are zeroing in on migrants as an issue, scapegoating them. He called migration the gospel issue of our time. You know, I just very struck by this leader of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, who is quite vocal about this specific issue, kind of unafraid and clearly speaking openly. It's not something we kind of see too much of these days, and I found it very interesting and striking.
Yeah, he has a remarkable ability to have a gentle presence to speak with great force. You spoke with him specifically about the praise that he's received from Pope Francis and what it's like being singled out by the Pope for his work on migration. And it reminded me of back in 2019, Bishop Seitz was participating in a conference at the Vatican on migration organized by the Migrants and Refugees section of the Vatican. And he was really intent in that meeting to give the Pope prayer cards of children that had been separated from their parents at the border. This was at the height of the Trump administration's family separation policy. And, you know, he made an effort to make sure the Pope knew their stories. And I think that left a real significant impression on the Pope. And we've since seen the Pope single out Seitz several times. And, you know, as he says, it's quite rare, but it also is encouraging when you get praise from the boss.
Well, that's a good place, I think, to wrap up today's episode. Thanks a lot for joining us today for the Vatican Briefing. You can find our show notes and all our work at National Catholic Reporter at ncronline.org. And if you listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other service, please don't forget to click subscribe. That way you're notified each time we have a new episode. Until next time, you've been briefed.
The Vatican Briefing is a production of National Catholic Reporter. John Grosso is your executive producer. Joshua McAlee and Christopher White are your producers and hosts. The editing was done by Angie Von Slaughter in conjunction with David Dalt of Sandberg Media. Today's music is provided by Blue Dot Sessions. This podcast and NCR's future media initiative are made possible in part by the generosity of Bill and Jean Buchanan.